The wolf on the hill is never as hungry as the wolf climbing the hill.
Lone wolf is a term commonly used by many people. It means that they used to belong to a group, but left, to become stronger. By thinking and acting alone, the lone wolf acquires superior cunning, agility, imagination, and skills unknown to members of the pack. The lone wolf is independent of and distances itself from the petty bickerings, expectations, demands, mediocrities, and unfulfilled dreams of other people, groups, or organizations. The lone wolf is often branded as the rebel.
For it is the sovereign lone wolf who stands alone in all of his or her glory. You are listening to Lone Wolf Radio, presented and hosted by Tom Metzger. Tom is now broadcasting from a newly relocated and improved bunker in an undisclosed location with internet access across the globe. So sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode on Lone Wolf Radio.
Is the past prologue. In Germany, rowdy young men drag a Turkish man out of a cafe and beat him until his skull is fractured. A Turkish family that had lived in Germany for 20 years is burned to death when their home is torched by a mob. Desecrations of Jewish graveyards are part of a wave of anti-Semitic terror. Gypsies, Kurds, Sudanese, Vietnamese, Pakistanis are all targets of neo-Nazi violence. This is happening in Germany today. In the United States, violent confrontations between blacks and whites are on the rise. Bands of youths rampage through an Orthodox Jewish community, murdering a young Hasidic scholar. What's behind the upsurge in racial, religious, and ethnic violence in Germany, here, and around the world? We'll ask our guests. Kevin Rafferty, co-producer of the documentary Blood in the Face, a study of American neo-Nazi groups, and by satellite from California, Thomas Metzger, founder of WAR, White Aryan Resistance. Later in the show, we'll be joined from Washington by Yaron Zvoreh, an Israeli journalist who infiltrated Germany's neo-Nazi movement, and Mark Weitzman of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our distinguished panel.
Direct from Studio 2 at CNBC, McLaughlin, a spontaneous, unrehearsed discussion on today's most interesting issues and personalities. And now your host, John McLaughlin.
Kevin Rafferty, in the production of your film, Blood in the Face, you did a great deal of research. So I'd like to have you profile for us the phenomenon of hate groups in the United States.
Well, I'm not an expert on hate groups, but I can tell you what my experience was being amongst these people. Other people have got the statistics and the facts. In fact, I'll just take this opportunity. My partner, James Ridgway, wrote
James
this.
Ridgway of Village Voice.
Yes, of the Village Voice, the national correspondent. And here's my partner on the film. Wrote a really excellent book with the same title, Blood in the Face, which will give you a lot of the facts and figures and a sense of the history also. This is available from Thunder's Mouth Press. My experience going out there was that what I knew about the Ku Klux Klan before going into this project was what I'd seen in the movies and seen in newsreels from the 20s and 30s and then the 60s again. And I was apprehensive. I thought, God, we're going into the middle of this group of Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazi, Aryan Nation type people. I was a little apprehensive. And
Nation of Islam, were they involved? Any blacks involved?
Well, they talk about forming these alliances with the black Muslims, but, you know, it really didn't.
No Black Panther militia?
No, there were not. They claimed to have some Puerto Rican nationalists there and various stuff.
Any members of Mr. Metzger's group, Tom Metzger, the WAR?
I don't think so. But there were plenty of members from the Aryan Nations. There were plenty of neo-Nazi groups, and there were large Klan factions at this gathering in Michigan.
Is it your belief that the incidence of, I guess we would call it domestic terrorism, that takes place because of the actions of these hate groups is on the increase?
I think that as the leadership, or as the membership of these groups shrinks, the leadership is becoming more vocal and more hip, and they've got using television technology, as Mr. Metzger has done very successfully. And they become a sort of a symbolic force. But if you compare the numbers to the 60s, you'll see that the membership is down from what...
The membership is way down. A gentleman who does the research for the Anti-Defamation League says the numbers have shrunk from 11,500 10 years ago to 4,500 today. But... I'm not sure that's the whole picture. I'd like to ask Thomas Metzger, who is the head of the White Aryan Resistance. Number one, what does the White Aryan Resistance stand for?
It stands for, number one, resistance against the oppressive criminals in Washington that we feel are inhibiting the advancement of the white race in the United States, and also through its imperialistic policies around the world, causing us problems everywhere.
In your June newsletter, the brand new newsletter, you say that the preferred form of government of WAR, the White Aryan Resistance, is an Aryan oligarchy based on genetic aristocracy and a modern form of feudalism. Is that your understanding,
yes,
of what your desired and preferred form of government is?
I think if you understand those terms, yes. That is what I would call the survival of the fittest, the evolution of the best. And that would be the approach I would use. Since all governments are oligarchy anyhow, we feel it should be based on race and culture.
Do you regard yourself as a neo-Nazi, Mr. Metzger?
I regard myself as a white separatist and a pan-Aryanist as opposed to, say, a Pan-African.
What does a Pan-Aryanist mean?
A Pan-Aryanist is one who is moderately a nationalist racially, but he also works very closely as possible with people from other white people from around the world. Our contacts have been way into Eastern Europe, into the Ukraine, into Russia, and South Africa, Australia, all over the world. We believe that the white people, being the minority in the world, must stick together. However, they do want territorial imperative. They want their own nation states. We don't believe in a world dictatorship like the criminals in Washington do.
Do you regard yourself as a white supremacist?
I regard myself as a white separatist. Nature will decide whether one race is supreme to another. I don't make that decision. I have been meeting just in the last 2 weeks. I spoke to the Black Panther Militia National Convention in Dallas, over 200 of their people. I just recently met in Florida with the Republic of New Africa people. Neither one of us are interested in talking about supremacy. We're talking about survival and what programs we can work on that would go along with both our programs.
Had you been a member of the Ku Klux Klan?
From 1975 until 1980, I was the leader in California of the Knights of the KKK.
Why did you leave the Klan?
The same reason I began to leave the right wing, and that's something that Mr. Ridgway and the gentleman there have missed. In fact, the film is quite misleading. This is actually sort of the end of the old right-wing racial people, beginning of a new movement which is strictly racial separatist, and people are coming from the left and the right, and many, many from the left now. And we look at things a lot different than the old right wing, and we don't like the term right wing.
Do you have anything in common with the Klan today?
Very few. Most of the Klan is gone today. There's possibly one or two Klans around that we could work with that are progressive, but most of them will not move out of their right-wing, conservative, reactionary mode and tend to be too supportive of the system. We've moved away from the mass strategy into a revolutionary strategy.
We'll be right back.
Working class people, your everyday all-American people, and we have to experience the government forced programs of race mixing and white genocide, and we realize that the only thing we've got to thank us for the position we're in is our white culture, and we're not going to let it be destroyed by any subhuman trash.
White power!
We have just watched a scene from your film, Kevin Rafferty. The film Blood in the Face, right?
Yes.
What did we just see? I want Mr. Metzger to understand what we just saw.
It was a group called the SS Action Group that operates out of Detroit. They had come to this national gathering in Cahokta, Michigan, which is run by Bob Miles, an old colleague of yours, I believe. And that was one of many factions that came from around the country to see if they could form these alliances.
Amongst themselves?
Amongst themselves, including Klan and neo-Nazi groups that never used to get along because the Klan would question the sexuality and patriotism of the neo-Nazis.
If you could get them all together, Tom Metzger, how many do you think they would number?
Well, at the old right, which this is really, things are moving so fast now that this film does not really project what's happening, because there was a lot of uniform freaks and a lot of these kind of people there that we don't believe we're in that kind of mode anymore, and there was no presence of any people from the left and some of the more radical environmentalists and so forth. So as far as getting together, we don't count heads because we're not in a mass movement.
How many in White Aryan Resistance, your organization?
Well, it's simply a voluntary association. We don't count heads. It's not very many. But we do have a television show in over 15 states, and we are on in about 50 markets around the country, and our videotapes go into Europe and around the world. We're not interested in masses of people signing up because we're not into a Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal mode. We're in a revolutionary mode, and we're moving fast. And what's happening in Europe today is a forerunner of what will happen here. And it proves one thing, that violence works. The German people, or the percentage of German people, which is a small percentage, that have stood up against, there's a lot of crime against white people in Germany by Turks, but now you see the government is stopping immigration. So violence works, and eventually they will eject the Turks. Possibly the same thing should happen here in regards to illegal aliens.
You take the position, also, this is from your newsletter, WAR, that's your organization, W-A-R, White Aryan Resistance, advises all U.S. racial activists to concentrate on freeing North America of aliens and racial suicide. North America is in the midst of negrophilia on an unprecedented level. Semite power is very strong in Canada and needs to be brought down. War salutes all the Aryan struggles around the world, but the motto, charity begins at home, must be the watchword. Does this reflect your views, and is this part of your goal?
That's very true, but we must make one thing very clear. Our number one enemy are the Washington criminals, who are primarily white, and the economic elite in this country, who are primarily white, and the tops of the Republican and the Democrat parties and so forth.
Do you associate?
We are willing to sit down with separatists from around the world, including black separatists. Some black separatists want part of this country. Some want repatriation. We're willing to sit down with any of these groups on a separatist basis.
Do you associate the U.S. government personnel with the Zionist movement?
Well, Zionism is a movement for the betterment of Jews. Pan-Africanism is for the betterment of Africans. And Pan-Aryanism is for the betterment of Euro-American people and white people around the world. I have no real problem with people fighting for their own interests. That's not a problem with me. Our problem here is white people. It's white people, lazy white people, greedy white people, corrupt white people, and a non-leadership in this country that's allowed tens of millions of people to immigrate in this country that are really screwing up the culture entirely in this country. It's going to lead to social evolution, revolution, and whatever as time goes on.
Kevin, you've been sitting there patiently listening to Tom Metzger talk about the white Aryan resistance. Now, what do you think of what you just heard?
Well, certainly, some of what Mr. Metzger says is liable to lead some people to acts of violence, and has, and a jury has found that it has. But
a jury has found?
Yeah, I believe so, in the Seattle case. But I see him as he's like the Abbie Hoffman of the redefined radical right, even though he doesn't want to call himself right. I
mean, thanks for the compliment.
It's as American as apple pie. He's got his own little TV show. He used to be a TV repairman. He makes these shows. He puts them out. He's on your show. You're asking him serious questions.
We're trying to get at the root of hate groups and why they operate and how extensive they are. We'll be right back.
Work to create a moral and a decent future for our race and a future in which our children and future generations can and will scream from their hearts truthfully and unashamedly, one God, one race, one nation. Ich bin ein Deutschlander, ich lebe Deutschen, Sieg Heil, and White Power.
White Power!
We just saw another piece of your film, is that right? What
yes.
Did we just see?
That was Glenn Miller, who's from the Carolinas. He had a paramilitary group. He's a former Green Beret.
He also appeared to have a Christian signal, a symbol on the beret.
Yes, there's a lot
of... Was that a cross?
Yes. There's a lot of religion involved.
But
he
also used Hitlerian language, Sieg Heil.
But he's an interesting case in point about this whole spectrum of these groups. And he had this paramilitary outfit that was making a lot of noise down there. And he ultimately wound up testifying against members of the Order, the terrorist group, on the West Coast terrorist group, and Bob Miles, when they were involved in a federal sedition case, going back to the 1793, you know, Alien and Sedition Acts and everything.
He was a witness on the part of the prosecution?
He testified for the government and is now on a witness protection program. That fellow you just
Why
saw.
Why did he do that?
Well, he wanted to beat his own rap. He had some gun crime raps against him. There are a lot of different people in this movement, and they come at it from a lot of different angles, and I think some of them just want to be a large fish in a small pond. Some of them are sincere, some of them are not.
I want to know what the relationship is, if any, between the hate groups, the Aryan movement, if you will, and cults, C-O-L-T-S, the cults that are in America today. Can you speak to that, Tom Metzger?
Well, in responding to Kevin, I mean, people ratting on each other is nothing new in history. I think we've had a lot of people among the Washington criminals who have done that many times. I remember a man by the name of Nixon and had a little problem with that. But I think what we're dealing here is that you're living in the Stone Age. Events are moving so fast, your old apparatus can't keep up. This is the last days of the Romanovs. We're moving into the 21st century, and the super state isn't going to make it. Separatist movements around the world and separate, they're even wanting to chop California up into three pieces. Now, to Kevin, if he wants to bring himself up to speed, and you too, John, you should pick up the book Siege, which is the latest writings by a movement or a resistance member in Denver, Colorado, 400 and some pages, which outline a program of revolution. And if you think it's funny, just keep snickering.
What are your impressions of Waco and David Koresh, Tom Metzger?
Well, my impressions is that I oppose the government in that operation. I went to Waco. I went to the site. Those people could have got up every morning and shot in 360-degree circle. I mean, they could have shot in any direction, not hit anybody. They're way out in the middle of nowhere, so why didn't they leave them alone? I don't agree with the religious position, but that doesn't make any difference. I defend a lot of people who I don't agree with because I against the government that's becoming so oppressive. The Weaver trial is just getting over up in Idaho.
What's the Weaver trial?
The Weaver trial is where a man and his family were living way back up in the mountains. He was accused of selling a couple of shotguns that were an inch short on the barrel or something like that. Anyhow, it ended up that the federal people came in there with gunships and snipers. They shot his wife, blew her head off, they shot his son, killed their dog, killed everything they could kill. And that case now is in Boise, and the press has hardly covered it all. And that the jury is out right now, and I would hope they come back with an acquittal, because we have gangsters posing as ATF people, FBI people, and so forth. These are nothing but gangsters.
You know, there is a sufficient modicum of truth in what you say so as to present a veneer of rationality to your general exposition, Mr. Metzger.
Well, I would say the same thing to you people in the media, John, and the people in Washington. You do the same thing.
Well, let me pick up that point. For example, in the case of the Weavers, it was said correctly, I believe, by Irwin Sewell, who represents the research arm of the Anti-Defamation League, that in going in, as the government forces did, to apprehend Weaver, they have created a martyr. And he said that this is counterproductive in so many words.
Of course,
And although you approach it from a different direction, you happen to have lurched somehow into the truth, sir. That is what a lot of people believe. Also, it is true that in a democracy, we have a number of constituent groups. And it's entirely possible, plausible, and necessary that they argue for their own interest.
Well, this is
but
why.
They do not discriminate on the basis of genetics, as you do, number one, and get into other extremes of discrimination, as you do. Number two, you have been involved, have you not, in violence, as was the case with the killing of the Ethiopian student or young man in Seattle, for which you are now being sued and you will have to pay. Please correct me or sort this out if you will. $12 million.
That case is still under appeal, but I will say this. A free man discriminates. A slave cannot discriminate. Anyone who is saddled by law that can't discriminate is a slave. And, of course, I support discrimination for any reason anyone wants to discriminate.
Discrimination on reasonable, on democratic grounds, or discrimination by reason of heredity and geneticism and color?
Look, the conservatives used to stand for the racial position, but now they have shed their cloak and become simply economic determinists like their leftist friends. The whole conservative movement, which I get a notion that you may represent, has lost any right to really stand for the bulk of white American citizens. And that is what is leading people into the position. Now they know they can't even go out in the mountains and the hills and live in a cabin with no electricity. The system comes after them. This system in Washington has to be taken apart.
Why is it that we have not seen you develop any level of success in political activity, Tom Metzger? You ran for the House of Representatives in 1980. And you were ignominiously defeated. True or false?
Well, I won the Democratic nomination of the party, and if I would have spent as much money as my opponent did, I think I would have won. I ran for U.S. Senate in 1982, received 80-some thousand votes in California. If I'd spend, and of course you have to buy your seats now, the person usually that spends the most money wins, and so I didn't have the money to spend. Maybe next time I would. But I'm out of politics now. I don't believe the answer anymore is at the ballot box.
Well, David Duke had a lot of money, and David Duke is now a dead letter in American politics.
Well, doesn't that
mean that all you have to do is run your course and eventually you will just slip into obscurity?
Well, I'm telling you that the things that are, with 6 million people going to lose their jobs because of this stupid free trade agreement and the problems of immigration in this country and 10, 15 million Hispanics that have moved in here and so forth, it's just beginning. Stand by, John. It's going to get hot.
You want to keep Hispanics out, Mexicans out?
I would certainly seal the border, and I'd remove every illegal alien and every green card holder in this country that's come from south of the border.
Our time has expired.
And I would do it very quickly.
Kevin, I get 5 seconds to conclude this segment before we move on.
I have nothing to add.
Nothing to add. Thank you very much, Tom Metzger, for being our guest.
Exclusive. The Russiagate hysteria has witnessed a widespread collapse of journalistic standards as major U.S. news outlets ignore rules about how to treat evidence in dispute, writes Robert Perry. By Robert Perry, a danger in both journalism and intelligence is to allow an unproven or seriously disputed fact to become part of the accepted narrative where it gets widely repeated and thus misleads policymakers and citizens alike, such as happened during the run-up to war with Iraq and is now recurring amid the frenzy over Russiagate. The New York Times building in Manhattan. Photo credit, Robert Perry, for instance, in a Russiagate story on Saturday, the New York Times reported as flat fact that a Kremlin intermediary told a Trump campaign aide, George Papadopoulos, that the Russians had dirt on Mr. Trump's rival, Hillary Clinton, in the form of thousands of emails. The Times apparently feels that this claim no longer needs attribution, even though it apparently comes solely from the 32-year-old Papadopoulos as part of his plea bargain over lying to the FBI. Beyond the question of trusting an admitted liar like Papadopoulos, his supposed Kremlin contact, Professor Joseph Mifsud, a little-known academic associated with the University of Stirling in Scotland, denied knowing anything about Democratic emails. In an interview with the UK Daily Telegraph, Mifsud acknowledged meeting with Papadopoulos but disputed having close ties to the Kremlin and rejected how Papadopoulos recounted their conversations. Specifically, he denied the claim that he mentioned emails containing dirt on Clinton. Even New York Times correspondent Scott Shane noted late last month, after the criminal complaint against Papadopoulos was unsealed, that a crucial detail is still missing, whether and when Mr. Papadopoulos told senior Trump campaign officials about Russia's possession of hacked emails. And it appears that the young aide's quest for a deeper connection with Russian officials, while he aggressively pursued it, led nowhere. Shane added, the court documents describe in detail how Mr. Papadopoulos continued to report to senior campaign officials on his efforts to arrange meetings with Russian officials. The documents do not say explicitly whether, and to whom, he passed on his most explosive discovery, that the Russians had what they considered compromising emails on Mr. Trump's opponent. J.D. Gordon, a former Pentagon official who worked for the Trump campaign as a national security advisor and who dealt directly with Papadopoulos, said he had known nothing about Mr. Papadopoulos' discovery that Russia had obtained Democratic emails or of his prolonged pursuit of meetings with Russians. Missing corroboration, but the journalistic question is somewhat different. Why does the Times trust the uncorroborated assertion that Mifsud told Papadopoulos about the emails and trust the claim to such a degree that the newspaper would treat it as flat fact? Absent corroborating evidence, isn't it just as likely, if not more likely, that Papadopoulos is telling the prosecutors what he thinks they want to hear? Former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos. If the prosecutors working for Russiagate independent counsel Robert Mueller had direct evidence that Mifsud did tell Papadopoulos about the emails, you would assume that they would have included the proof in the criminal filing against Papadopoulos, which was made public on October 30. Further, since Papadopoulos was peppering the Trump campaign with news about his Russian outreach in 2016, you might have expected that he would include something about how helpful the Russians had been in obtaining and publicizing the Democratic emails. But none of Papadopoulos's many emails to Trump campaign officials about his Russian contacts, as cited by the prosecutors, mentioned the hot news about dirt on Clinton or the Russians possessing thousands of emails. This lack of backup would normally raise serious doubts about Papadopoulos's claim, but, since Papadopoulos was claiming something that the prosecutors and the Times wanted to believe, reasonable skepticism was swept aside. What the Times seems to have done is to accept a bald assertion by Mueller's prosecutors as sufficient basis for jumping to the conclusion that this disputed claim is undeniably true. But just because Papadopoulos, a confessed liar, and these self-interested prosecutors claim something is true doesn't make it true. Careful journalists would wonder, as Shane did, why Papadopoulos, who in 2016 was boasting of his Russian contacts to make himself appear more valuable to the Trump campaign, wouldn't have informed someone about this juicy tidbit of information, that the Russians possessed thousands of emails on Clinton. Yet, the prosecutor's statement regarding Papadopoulos's guilty plea is strikingly silent on corroborating evidence that could prove that, first, Russia did possess the Democratic emails, which Russian officials deny, and, second, the Trump campaign was at least knowledgeable about this core fact in the support of the theory about the campaign's collusion with the Russians, which President Trump and other campaign officials deny. Of course, it could be that the prosecutor's fact will turn out to be a fact as more evidence emerges, but anyone who has covered court cases or served on a jury knows that prosecutors' criminal complaints and pre-trial statements should be taken with a large grain of salt. Prosecutors often make assertions based on the claim of a single witness whose credibility gets destroyed when subjected to cross-examination. That is why reporters are usually careful to use words like alleged in dealing with prosecutors' claims that someone is guilty. However, in Russiagate, all the usual standards of proof and logic have been jettisoned. If something serves the narrative, no matter how dubious, it is embraced by the U.S. mainstream media, which, for the past year, has taken a lead role in the anti-Trump resistance. A history of bias. This tendency to succumb to confirmation bias, i.e., to believe the worst about some demonized figure, has inflicted grave damage in other recent situations as well. Secretary of State Colin Powell led Nations on February 5, 2003, citing satellite photos which supposedly proved that Iraq had WMD, but the evidence proved bogus. One example is described in the Senate Intelligence Committee's 2006 study of the false intelligence that undergirded the case for invading Iraq in 2003. That inquiry discovered that previously discredited WMD claims kept reemerging in finished U.S. intelligence analyses as part of the case for believing that Iraq was hiding WMD. In the years before the Iraq invasion, the U.S. government had provided tens of millions of dollars to Iraqi exiles in the Iraqi National Congress, and the Inc., in turn, produced a steady stream of walk-ins who claimed to be Iraqi government defectors with knowledge about Saddam Hussein's secret WMD programs. Some U.S. intelligence analysts, though faced with White House pressure to accept this evidence, did their jobs honestly and exposed a number of the defectors as paid liars, including one, who was identified in the Senate report as Source 2, who talked about Iraq supposedly building mobile biological weapons labs. CIA analysts caught Source 2 in contradictions and issued a fabrication notice in May 2002, deeming him a fabricator/provocateur and asserting that he had been coached by the Iraqi National Congress prior to his meeting with Western intelligence services. But the Defense Intelligence Agency never repudiated the specific reports that were based on Source 2's debriefings. Sourced who also continued to be cited in five CIA intelligence assessments and the pivotal National Intelligence Estimate in October 2002, as corroborating other source reporting about a mobile biological weapons program, the Senate Intelligence Committee report said. Thus, Source 2 became one of four human sources referred to by Secretary of State Colin Powell in his United Nations speech on February 5, 2003, making the case that Iraq was lying when it insisted that it had ended its WMD programs. The infamous curveball was another of these dishonest sources. Losing the thread after the U.S. invasion and the failure to find the WMD caches, a CIA analyst who worked on Powell's speech was asked how a known fabricator, Source 2, could have been used for such an important address by a senior U.S. government official. The analyst responded, "We lost the thread of concern as time progressed. I don't think we remembered." Washington Post's editorial page editor Fred Hyatt. A CIA supervisor added, "Clearly we had it at one point, we understood, we had concerns about the source, but over time it started getting used again and there really was a loss of corporate awareness that we had a problem with the source." In other words, like today's Russiagate hysteria, the Iraq WMD group think had spread so widely across U.S. government agencies and the U.S. mainstream media that standard safeguards against fake evidence were discarded. People in official Washington, for reasons of careerism and self-interest, saw advantages in running with the Iraq WMD pack and recognized the dangers of jumping in front of the stampeding herd to raise doubts about Iraq's WMD. Back then, the personal risk to salary and status came from questioning the Iraq WMD groupthink because there was always the possibility that Saddam Hussein indeed was hiding WMD and, if so, you'd be forever branded as a Saddam apologist, while there were few if any personal risks to agreeing with all those powerful people that Iraq had WMD, even if that judgment turned out to be disastrously wrong. Sure, American soldiers and the people of Iraq would pay a terrible price, but your career likely would be safe, a calculation that proved true for people like Fred Hyatt, the editorial page editor of the Washington Post who repeatedly reported Iraq's WMD as flat fact and today remains the editorial page editor of the Washington Post. Similarly, official Washington's judgment now is that there is no real downside to joining the resistance to Trump, who is widely viewed as a buffoon, unfit to be president of the United States. So, any means to remove him are seen by many important people as justified, and the Russian allegations seem to be the weightiest rationale for his impeachment or forced resignation. Professionally, it is much riskier to insist on unbiased standards of evidence regarding Trump and Russia. You'll just stir up a lot of angry questions about why are you defending Trump. You'll be called a Trump enabler and slash or a Kremlin stooge. However, basing decisions on dubious information carries its own dangers for the nation and the world. Not only do the targets end up with legitimate grievances about being railroaded, and not only does this prejudicial treatment undermine faith in the fairness of democratic institutions, but falsehoods can become the basis for wider policies that can unleash wars and devastation. We saw the horrific outcome of the Iraq War, but the risks of hostilities with nuclear-armed Russia are far graver. Indeed, billions of people could die and human civilization end. With stakes so high, the New York Times and Mueller's prosecutors owe the public better than treating questionable accusations as flat fact. Investigative reporter Robert Perry broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s.
Home put his Kevlar on wrong. I guarantee you'll meet up at the suicide bomb. Hell broke loose. Hell broke loose. Big fucking ditches in the middle of the road. You pay $100 just for filling in the hole. Listen to the general every goddamn word. How many ways can you polish up a turd? And left, right, left, left, right, left, right. Hell broke loose. Hell broke loose. Hell broke loose. How is it that the only ones responsible for making this mess got the sorry asses stapled to a goddamn desk? And hell broke loose. Hell. Chef. What was your name? It was Jeff. Jeff. I lost my buddy and I wept. Wept. I come down from the meth. So I slept. Slept. I had a good home but I left. Left. Joke. I pranced right in with the dope. Glanced at her shin, she said, nope. Coke. Left, right, left. Nimrod bought fish, have you any wool? Get me another body bag, the body bag's full. And my face was scorched, scorched. I miss my home, I miss my porch, porch. Left, right, left. Stands with a chin full of soap. That rancid dinner with the Pope. And left, right, left. Cali Prosciutto got his thumbs blown off. Sergio's developing a real bad cough. Sergio's developing a real bad cough. And hell broke loose. Hell broke loose. Hell. And boom went Bowery. Oh, what the hell was it that the president said? Give them all a beautiful parade instead. And